Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is a blackjack player who's calling himself Blade. We'll be speaking to Blade in a few minutes. We received an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com about a quarter triple play 9-6 double-double bonus machine with progressives. The Belt Royal is at $44,000. And the listener asked how to figure out how much that Delt Royal progressive added to the EV. The normal Royals for this game are $1,000 each. So with triple play, that makes $3,000. A $44,000 jackpot is $41,000 more than just the regular Royals. So since it takes 650,000 hands to hit the Delt Royal on average, and each hand costs you $3.75, you divide 41,000 by both 375 and 650, and you end up with about 1.7%. Since 9-6 double-double bonus is almost 99% to start with, yes, you have a long-term advantage. Since triple play is slower than regular video poker, even playing 650 hands an hour, that's 1,000 hours, which takes 6 months if you only play 40 hours a week. And you might not be the guy who hits it. Locking up all the machines for a six-month duration is simply not practical or cost-effective for a quarter progressive. More relevant as to whether you need to play today is what the other progressives are. Let's say they're $1,100, $1,500, and $1,300. You take the average of those three progressives, find out how much it returns, and then you go from there. Hitting the 44,000 would be nice, but a 1,000 hour would be nice is, when you're probably not going to be the one who hits it, is not something I would let affect my decision. Let's talk to our guest. After teaching computer science and playing poker part-time for several years, in 2016, Blade supported himself almost entirely by playing blackjack in Las Vegas and elsewhere. He's here today to talk about those experiences from last year. Blade, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hey, thank you, guys.
Did you play solo or with teammates?
Almost exclusively solo.
And can you talk about how the decision to play full-time, how did that happen?
Yeah, that's worth some background story. The bio is a little short. Sorry, I cheated you there, Bob. In between teaching and playing blackjack for a year, I helped start and run a software company. And we sold the company a couple of years ago. And so I basically quit my job and went out on the road and actually lived all over the country in an RV for a couple of years. And during that time, one of the things that I'd always wanted to do was do some advantage play. And I had dabbled a little bit over the years, but never really put my mind to it. And it was a good opportunity to take advantage of some of the downtime to do that. So the background was that I knew I had this opportunity, and I also just really wanted to file my taxes with the IRS as a professional gambler for the first time in my life. So those were big goals for me.
That's funny because many professional gamblers try to avoid filing as a professional gambler because they think that it may be some kind of red flag. But I personally don't have an objection to it, but I know there are people who avoid that.
Well, before I did that, I had played poker on the side for many years, since before the poker boom back in LA even. And, you know, I had a real job outside of gambling. And when you file as a normal person and then you have a bunch of wins and losses that net out to a small win, you basically get screwed in the U.S. tax code. So I've kind of been, seething slowly about that for a decade, and I finally got back at him by getting the file and net all my losses with all my wins. And I had a lot of wins and losses in blackjack last year. So that's how I got started.
So when you sold the software company, was the idea to you're married and have kids, right?
Yeah, I have a elementary school age daughter.
So was the idea to get an RV and just travel around the country with your family, and blackjack was going to be kind of a sideline, or was it I'm going out to play blackjack and I'm going to take my family with me?
It was the other way. So we had the opportunity before school to do the road trip, and so we felt like, you know, my job was coming to an end. There was a natural pause before the demands of school and not being truant came into play. So we took advantage and decided to go on the road. At the same time, I had been kind of casting about for something else to do, and blackjack was a pretty good fit with that. So it sort of just came along for the ride. Although I think if we had been home, I probably still would have pursued it, just to say I did it, if for no other reason.
How much of the U.S. did you travel on this trip?
We covered a pretty good swath. We went all the way up, all the way into British Columbia, down to the tip of Florida. We were on the road, I guess, about 16 months. So you don't have to go very fast, and you still get to a lot of places.
What was your bankroll, and what were you betting?
Good question. So bankroll's a little weird because I don't really need to play blackjack to sustain myself. But I certainly wanted to treat it like a job. I'm happy that I did that, because imposing a certain degree of rigor on the way you approach advantage play, I think, is really important even to getting good results in the short term. Bankroll is a little bit fuzzy. Effectively, for this type of stakes that I think you can play, at least in the U.S., my bankroll looked effectively like infinity, which sounds a little pompous or crazy, but I played to the highest stakes that I thought I could get away with.
Given a particular casino. So in one casino, your top bet might be $500, and in another casino, several thousand dollars?
That's true. I mean, my benchmark was Vegas Strip casinos with standard 10K max bets. You know, the kind of table you can walk up to in a high limit room and play. I haven't considered or pursued trying to get access to even larger games. I think that would be very difficult for a lot of reasons. But if you look at 10K max blackjack tables, you would never bet anywhere near the max for exposure reasons. So realistically, I mean, I think a top bet is something like 2x 3K would be about as high as you'd want to go in the biggest high limit rooms that you can walk into in a place like Las Vegas. And most of the other joints around the U.S. are smaller, sometimes considerably smaller, even orders of magnitude. To be fair, although we were traveling around, I didn't spend a whole lot of time wasting time in these smaller casinos playing smaller games, except just to kind of, you know, just to have a little bit of fun and keep sharp. It's tempting, but when the max is, you know, I live in Colorado, we have a max $100 bet, so that's going to put a pretty hard limit on what you can earn. And so there's only so much time you'd want to spend in a smoky, well, not in Colorado, but in a smoky casino, earning $4.73 EV an hour.
Yeah. Did you have a goal as to a per hour target? Like, I want to make X amount per hour, or the game isn't worth playing?
That's another good question. So I sort of did. I kind of edged my way into it. There's a great tool, part of the Casino Verite suite, called CVCX, that'll allow you to model EV and a lot of other things. It's a good, quick way to get your head around what you might be looking at from an EV perspective. And I started there before really playing at all, because I did want to know kind of what could I expect to earn. And I think in a good high-limit game, you can, you know, with good conditions, you can easily be seeing EV rates in upwards, closing in on four digits, you know, maybe $1,000 an hour, maybe a little more. Now there are a lot of caveats to that number. But my effective average, including time spent at casinos with much lower stakes, was about a little over $600 per play hour, in that last year in 2016. I logged just under 200 hours of actual play.
So was that win or was that estimated EV?
Good point. So my estimated EV for all of those games, and it's a crude estimate since I'm having to back into those games after walking into them and try to crudely approximate it, was a little bit less. So my math shows that I'm probably about a third of a standard deviation above the expected result. So I was probably playing about $500 an hour game on average across all the games I played.
And
it's a little hard to say because
limits that you play. Like, did you play in Arizona where some casinos are a maximum 500 limit?
Lowest limits were Colorado, where the maximum bet is $100 at any one time. Now, in Colorado, you can spread as many spots as you want on the table, so you can theoretically get 500 or 600 down. And strangely enough, you don't really get looked at even for that, because there are lots of people who would like to bet more, but we have the nanny state. So those were actually, because I live in Colorado, those were places where I could kind of practice and work on things with sort of lower risk. So those were the lowest stakes, and I have a lot of hours logged at those games as well.
How long had you been counting before this road trip started?
I hadn't really been counting at all, although I was familiar with high-low, and I had played a little bit of blackjack casually in the past, just on trips for, you know, that were where I went to play poker. So I had dabbled with tracking a count in my head previously, and also kind of modulating my bet with respect to the count. So I was familiar with the concept, but I really need to sit down with a simulator and just crank out a whole lot of hands and get to where I had it, had it internalized, so I wasn't having to think consciously about counting. But that also happened. I did a little bit of that at the end of 2015, knowing I was going to go full-on professional the next year. And again, I got some of that in at, you know, low stakes places, like around here, where I could basically play with not much downside, even if they did call me out.
And were you using the high low?
Yeah, I just used straight up high low. In fact, one of the things that's frustrating for me is I try to learn about things by going online and joining communities. And one of the problems with, I think, with a lot of the card counting forums and communities such as they are, is that there are a lot of people in there who are kind of like me. They're like math geeks or whatever, but they spend a lot of time talking about, you know, a lot of very fine grained details around counting and alternate counts and multiple level counts and things. And my finding is if you want to go after the money, and in particular if you have my mindset where you're in it as kind of a professional hobby, maybe it's not going to be something you do your whole life. Maybe getting backed off and burned out is not the end of the world one day. If you go into it with that mindset and you want to maximize earnings, spending a lot of time on finer grained details around counting is kind of a waste of time. So a basic count, I think, works really well. And there are a bunch of other dynamics to focus on that involve the actual casinos and the people that deserve more attention than whether you know the 12th index adjusted for whether there's a surrender or whatever. I just kind of ignored all of that once the math showed that it wasn't going to make much of a difference.
You're preaching to the choir.
It sounds like he's a member of the Richard Munchman School of card counting here. It's amazing to me that you could get up to speed in 3 months to go out and be a
close to a professional level AP.
Well, one of the things that was hard about that was I didn't know. And there's so much variance in the game that, I have a technical background. I know that I don't know whether I'm actually playing at advantage. And frankly, even with 200 hours and, 1,200 shoes or whatever it was, I still haven't actually converged on whether I'm a winning player. The confidence intervals, is narrowing. I feel better, but it's hard to say. So I think that's one of the challenges too for a beginning counter. No matter where you're coming in at, is you have so many things coming at you at once. You have bankroll, risk of ruin. You have the overwhelming sensory environment of the casino. You have to actually count, and you could do everything right. All the stars could align, and you could be screwed for more than a year of playing easily just by bad luck. But one advantage that I had, in addition to having spent a lot of time in the casino and being very comfortable around cards and people and dealers, is that I play poker. And poker's variance, makes stock market and investing look like a flat sea of tranquility. And so it kind of prepared me a little bit for the swings and the downswings and the bad runs. So I was sort of psychologically a little bit better prepared and able to kind of get above some pretty serious losses. And I just have an unacceptable disregard for money when I'm in the casino. Happy to just treat them as little pieces of plastic and not think about the dollars.
How long was the longest losing streak?
I should have done that math. I'll have to ask the computer here to try to figure that out. But so basically the way this worked is, though I was on the road in the RV, I made 5 or 6 intentional trips to Vegas to play there at kind of some of the peak times. So, the Lunar New Year and March Madness and, a variety of other times of the year when I normally would have gone to play poker. Instead I went to play blackjack. And so I made 6 of these sort of 3 or 4 day trips. And, there was just one where I think I lost like 14 sessions in a row. And when you're playing high limit, it was a big swing in dollar terms. I feel like it was, I'm just looking here. It was something like, lose 100K in 8 hours of play or something. It was pretty shoddy. Felt like it was kind of canceling out my whole year at that point. But really, those were, I think, if you looking at the math, I'm not even sure those were big downswings.
I was going to say 14 sessions.
To have much larger ones.
14 sessions in a row with the amount of money that you said you were betting, you could easily have lost 200,000-300,000, maybe even 500,000.
Yeah, and I've had sessions where I've sat down and just dumped 50K and had to get up and leave because I've hit my limit, my exposure, my ability to get chips on the table. Actually getting chips on the table is one of the hardest things about playing at high stakes and trying to do it survivably. Because you can't be yourself. You have to have an alternate identity.
Well, so that's a whole kettle of fish that we should start exploring. So did you play with a player's card under your real name, or did you try to do this as a refusal?
Neither of those. I played under a player's card that was not my real name.
Okay. So that means that you had cash transaction restrictions. You couldn't get in more than $10,000 at a time?
Exactly. So with the changes with FinCEN and the rules around, trying to clamp down on money laundering, anybody that moves cash, money handling institutions like casinos and banks have to keep track of and file reports on large cash transactions. And this means, practically speaking, that most casinos will start looking at trying to record what you're doing when you move cash into chips or vice versa at much smaller increments. Usually about $2,000 is the threshold. Even though the government reporting threshold is $10,000 in a 24-hour period. So what you find practically is that as soon as you go and try to cash in more than about 4 purple $500 chips, they want to see ID or they want to see a player's card. So you need one if you're going to do that. And the other thing is, the end game for you is if you have to give up your social security number, which you would have to do if you hit that 10K limit. So, it's tricky because you're playing a game where you might need to put $100,000 in chips on the table, but you can't actually move more than, you know, somewhat less than 10,000 a day, or you're going to have to give up your identity. And once you do that, my theory was, then I'm going to be screwed. So my goal was to never give them my actual social security number. And of course you can't lie about your social security number.
No, I mean, so, I'm actually surprised at your level of sophistication given that you didn't have teammates and you kind of came out of the cold and sort of knew these things from reading forums or of course from listening to Gambling with an Edge.
I mean, the reason I'm on this show is not because I want to give away all my secrets, but because I want to give back. And yeah, I learned a lot on this show from a handful of your interviews with actual modern blackjack players. I did a fair bit of reading. I read most of the literature. A lot of it's out of date with respect to today. And then I was familiar with the FinCEN stuff from poker. You know, I'd run into it before, not that it was an issue then. I could just identify as my real self. But I did a lot of thinking about how to create and structure, you know, a whole, basically a persona under which I could play. And I went as far as, you know, obtaining identification so that I could get players' cards. I have credit cards in the name of my person so I can actually check in as that person under comps and charge. You know, if someone rifled through my stuff, they would see my alternate identity. And I think it would be very difficult without, you know, involving me with the actual legal apparatus in Nevada to figure out who I was. So that actually worked very well, but it took 6 months of runway to set up all the, you know, the mailing addresses and the post office and the forwarding and the ID and all the credit cards and everything so that I could actually walk into a casino as this other person and play with some confidence that I wasn't going to go to jail if I got caught.
Well, how did you manage to, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but how did you manage to get the ID? Because certainly many players have, you know, been arrested for having a fake ID.
Yeah, I wasn't so much concerned about being arrested. I was concerned about being convicted.
Yeah, I get it.
But the rules vary by state, so you have to look at that pretty carefully. I'm certainly no attorney, but in general, if you're not attempting to commit fraud with your identity, with your ID, then you're facing a misdemeanor at worst. I was never intending to commit any fraud anywhere. I just didn't want the casino to be able to leverage the FinCEN rules to figure out who I was and then shut me down. So I figured that I just basically decided to take a calculated risk. And in practice, after obtaining the player's card, you really don't actually need the ID at all.
Right.
So you don't have to carry it. So I just have a bunch of players' cards with another person's name on them. And that person is sort of real in the sense that they have a mailing address, I have a phone number, they have an email, and so on. And my assumption was I was going to get burned out and that I would need to dispose of that identity. And then if I wanted to do it again, I'd need to start over. In practice, I don't think I have been. And that was the one thing that's kind of surprised me is that I was able to, by giving up a lot of EV and applying a lot of cover, maybe I've just gotten lucky, it's hard to say, but I haven't actually had too much adverse action from the casinos in the play that I've put out so far.
Now, would you play very short sessions, kind of a hit-and-run strategy, or what?
Generally, yes. I played to... So my mindset was when I go into this casino, first of all, if I'm playing on my card and this is a chain, then I need to think about all the sessions I've played at that chain, especially in the near term. So if I'm in Vegas and I go to one MGM property, when I go to the next MGM property, I might as well, to some extent, my play could get aggregated. And the way that I think about it is I'm just assuming that at high stakes, they're actually employing software that looks at the math, looks at the cards that are played, and calculates the probability that I'm playing at an advantage. So what I'm trying to do when I play is play a session until I feel like the combination of the cards that have come out, the counts that I've encountered, and the bets that I've made make it more likely that the software can converge on the fact that I'm playing at an advantage. And what I'm so to answer your question, the sessions would vary a lot depending on the texture of the shoes. So I could sit down and play a couple of shoes where, for whatever reason, the count didn't fluctuate in ways that would make it obvious that that I was betting at an advantage. And in that case, I would play a little longer. Or I could sit down in this shoe that wobbled back and forth between being plus and minus EV, and I basically am reduced to flat betting the minimum, and I probably need to get out of there. Because if I play a first shoe like that and another shoe with a wildly different strategy, that's gonna raise eyebrows, and it's gonna make it easier for the computer to figure out what I'm doing too. So yeah, mostly short sessions, trying to keep them on their toes so that they're not able to aggregate all of that session data. I played as a refusal sometimes. Sometimes I would refuse and then give my card after I saw the results of the session, or halfway through, or if I wanted to extend the session. It kind of varied. But yeah, typically, my average session was, I'm just looking here, was like, 1.8 shoes typically. So less than a half an hour.
Right. And did you avoid double decks?
Didn't play I played a single deck a couple times in Reno for fun. But other than that, I didn't play any double decks. Everyone seemed to think that those were just a disaster. I'd actually, in previous life, casually playing blackjack, seen numerous people backed off at double deck high limit rooms. So there wasn't any way I was going to touch those. Plus, then I have to memorize a bunch of other counting rules and indices, and I'm not good at memorizing things. So that sounded like too much work. So yeah, I played all shoes. And I think shoes are really, that's really where the money's at if you're going to count cards blackjack in the U.S. right now.
Yep. Yeah, no, again, I agree. So now a whole nother issue is you had to have a lot of cash with you in this RV, and maybe were you stockpiling chips as well?
So in Vegas, I stockpiled chips. I was fortunate to have a couple of friends who live in the area who could actually help me buy chips to get started. So we would make these tours and just raid all the cages, and buy under the minimum number of chips so it didn't trigger anything. And I built up a pretty big supply. At one point I had nearly $250,000 in $500 chips, which are the biggest ones you want for your stockpile, by the way. Once you get to the yellows and bigger, they start to scrutinize very carefully. So, I'd have these poker racks with, they hold 100 chips, and I'd fill them up, and then we had this elaborate process, but I kept all that in chips and left it in Vegas in the bank. And I'd just pull those out on those trips. In the RV, it was a little bit different because everything was sort of on the spur of the moment, and I'd kind of wander into a casino. Practically speaking, it's really hard to play high stakes just kind of randomly on the road like that. So I generally would have 30 to 50K, but I mean, it's a huge RV. Like, civil forfeiture is an issue, I think, if you're just tooling down the road and carrying cash and it's you and a friend maybe in a car.
Cash and multiple IDs and other names, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I had heard about some of those. By the way, I think that stuff's pretty abysmal. I hope that society figures that out soon enough. Sounds like maybe there's some a little bit of progress there, at least in some states. But it wasn't much of a factor for me. I didn't really worry about it too much. For one thing, I was in a 45-foot, 50,000-pound motorhome. I had like a zillion things in there. I mean, dogs and kids and. I mean, if they really are going to tear through my home, one of the interesting things about a motorhome is that if it's your house, it's not like a car where they can just get you out of it and then kind of strong arm you into consent to search. They actually need a warrant to search your home, and that was my home.
I don't know. I mean, they need a warrant to search your car too, but you know, they make the dog bark and then they'd say they have probable cause. And but originally, yeah, it sounds like that didn't happen to you. You didn't have any problems with that.
It's definitely an untested area. High stakes blackjack player living out of motorhome, civil forfeiture in some questionable state in the Southwest. I don't know. Yeah, it didn't happen to me. It wasn't a big concern. I had more, I mean, I did have some issues. I'd run into a couple of issues moving money, through the airport, actually, back a few years ago before blackjack, just for poker. I'd had a couple of situations with the TSA that were, uncomfortable, but they worked out. But I generally didn't move a lot of cash. At the amounts that I needed, it was all done, you know, through a bank. So I'd have a branch locally and I'd go there once I got to my destination.
Well, but that's become a problem too. A lot of banks, you can't withdraw more. I mean, you go in and try to withdraw $20,000 or $30,000 and they might tell you it'll be a week before they can order the cash. And
you definitely have to call ahead for cash. I had gotten worried about midway through last year because I'd started reading reports of banks closing accounts, just not wanting the risk of interacting with customers where there was a lot of cash movement. And they have a lot of exposure, and the government's gotten picky about that with the new Know Your Customer rules and some of the money laundering stuff they've done. I think it's probably a good thing for society, but it's horrible for a blackjack player when you need to move cash that they've got those. I guess in my case, I was like, I didn't feel like I had a lot of things I could do about that. I was a long time customer with my bank, and I'd had like a decade of depositing and withdrawing lots of cash. So actually, I haven't had any issues, but you do have to call ahead. They need to know you're coming if you want to take 150K out of the bank or whatever.
150, yeah. I mean, a lot of places, it's an ordeal to get 20 or 30.
Yeah, it's funny. Like in a small town, so I have with my bank. I found out I could get an ATM card that would let me take out 4,000 per day, and they would issue multiple. So I actually have 4 ATM cards. That's 4 times 4,000 is 16K, and you can usually sweet talk them into giving you at least 10,000 if you walk into a branch. So if you're in Podunk, Missouri, and you walk in, I figured I could probably, if I really wanted to, walk out with, what's that, 26K if I really needed it for some, you know, amazing opportunity.
Yeah, if the ATM has 4,000, let alone 16,000 in it.
Sometimes the ones in the casino do. They're a little better about that. But it's pretty funny.
You know, have a pretty high cost to them.
That's true.
And the other one, did they ever give you the $4,000 in $20 bills?
Generally, there's a 40 bill limit on those machines, so you got to do a bunch of $800 transactions. So you got to do the math. If you're paying 50 basis points on all your money, you better have a good edge in your game, or you better just be desperate to play poker, like I sometimes. One of the two.
All right, we're talking to Blade about his blackjack experiences. We're going to take a brief break for commercials, and then we still have lots more questions for Blade, so stick around.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. All throughout May, Monday through Thursday, you may play in the $500,000 swipe, spin, and win game. Play 300 points between 3 a.m. and 11 p.m. and spin the wheel at the kiosk to get your prize. Prizes include free play, cash, resort gift cards, food coupons. On Memorial Day, Monday, May 29th, there'll be 2x points for video poker, bigger multipliers for reels, including 15x points for penny slots. Midnight to midnight, no limits, no machines excluded. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Ultimate X Bonus Streak. This is a 10 coin per line game where you receive bonuses next hand for certain winning scores on this hand. Unlike regular Ultimate X, you get a series of multipliers, and they require slightly higher hands to earn. For example, in the double-double bonus version, You need at least three of a kind to earn multipliers, so you do not get the multipliers for high pairs and two pair, and 60% of the multipliers you got in regular Ultimex were for high pairs and two pair. So the strategy is very different from regular Ultimate X. It's an interesting game. On the Wizard of Oz website, there is a strategy for a Jax or better version, which is somewhat under 99%. I have not seen better versions out there, nor do I know the strategy for them.
Okay, we're back talking to Blade. One of the questions I have is, in my writings, I'm a video poker player, I write a lot about things that happen between me and my wife, and she doesn't quite understand positive EV and wins and losses and stuff, and how I deal with that. Now, you're taking a wife and a kid around the country. Was your wife good with this $50,000 a day loss? Was your kid, when you take her to McDonald's, goes, "My daddy won $30,000 today from the casino. Isn't he smart?" I mean, how did you deal with all that?
That's funny you asked that question. My wife's sitting across the room from me right now, so I'm not going to look at her so I don't have to see her glaring at me. I'm just going to pretend she's not there. One good strategy is to pretend they're not there. No, I'm just kidding. So the funniest story was my kid started kindergarten this year, and I heard, or maybe it was the year before, I can't remember. She was at school, and I got word that, you know, they had this sharing time when they told what their parents do. And at the time, you know, she didn't know I had previously been in a business. She was too young. All she had known was that I played blackjack and occasionally got on the airplane to go do that. And so apparently she was telling the teacher that, you know, my dad's a blackjack player, which is true. But I would have loved to have seen the look on the face of the teachers at that point.
You know, other than that, when my older son was in kindergarten, the exact same thing happened. He came home. He said, "Oh, you know, the teacher asked what my father does for a living." And I said, "What did you tell her?" And she said, "I told her you play blackjack." And I said, "What did she say?" And he said, "Oh, that's nice." And I'm sure the teacher just, you know, didn't believe him.
Right.
And I told my son, you know, from now on, if they ask, just say writer.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But how do we handle the swings? So a couple different things. One, she had been used to my antics with poker in the past, and there are a lot of swings there, and it used to affect me a lot more. So I think, you know, I would share more of it. Now, especially with blackjack, it comes so fast, you know, especially if you're doing it intentionally, you're playing a lot of sessions, you just have huge wins and losses. And I really got to the point where I didn't feel it necessary to talk about every one of those. She's pretty, it's important to have a spouse that understands you enough to kind of deal with it. So I think she mostly just ignores me and kind of rolls her eyes and assumes that as long as I'm not tapping the 401k or something, that will probably be okay. But I have to tell you that I think it's harder on me than on the spouse when you just, you know, loss aversion is a tricky psychological thing, and you generally feel the losses more than the wins. And then when you string a bunch of losses together and you start to question whether what you're doing even makes sense, it is tough. And you have to be able to bounce back from that. In the family dynamic, I think for the most part, it hasn't been an issue. But then, as I said when we started, it wasn't really strictly necessary that I earn money from blackjack to be able to pay the bills. So this is, although I'm filing as a professional and think of it that way, we would be okay even if I lost, well, up to a point.
Now, sounds like you had quite a good sale on your software company.
Yeah, we did well. It was great and a lot of fun. But yeah, there are other fun things in life too.
Sure, yeah. So, did you ever get flyered, like you're playing Vegas or?
I don't think so. It's hard to know, if you were flyered, but I had, in all of the sessions, I had only one back off, and it was a very soft one, and it was not at one of the main chains, and I was goofing off and trying to help a friend learn, and betting way too weird for that little, off strip joint. I think I may have, been flyered in Biloxi, but I was heading out of town anyway, and I was willing to burn it, so, it's a little hard to say. I was definitely pushing the bounds, pushing the limits, there. But no, to my knowledge, I had not. And I was prepared for that eventuality, but either I'm not actually a good enough blackjack player, or I'm so good at trading EV for cover that, I just haven't yet. And that's been probably kind of my biggest surprise, is that if you read the forums and people talking about things, you see a lot about this, and people are always saying, Vegas is a wasteland, don't play blackjack there. And there's probably some truth to that, but, I mean, there are also very few places where you can play at those stakes, and I when I went into it, my assumption was I was going to get burned out, and then I would have to, if I wanted to do it again, I would have to wait quite a while, maybe years, and come at it again under a new identity, probably with a different look, even just to pull it off. And I was okay with that, but it didn't happen. I haven't had that happen yet. But I've only put in, 120 hours in at the big stores. So, maybe I've just been lucky.
Something that we haven't really talked about a lot on this show is I believe that if you bet more than $1,000, if you get up to the $2,000 and $3,000 range, the amount of heat goes down.
Absolutely.
Compared to a guy trying to bet $500 to $1,000.
No question.
There's
an inverse dynamic there.
Yep. Yeah.
And the other thing that happens, I mean, one of the reasons is that the people, so heat is tough to measure, and I'm very skeptical of the human heat in the room. I think in most cases, at least in the casinos that I observe, the people there, although they can be some very nice people and even some good people, for the most part, they're fairly low skilled and they're not actually capable of detecting a good counter in most cases. And so my theory has been that most of the real detection is going to come, from the camera and from some, 22-year-old getting paid minimum wage to type all my hands into the computer later and then see what the software says. So I've always assumed that my ultimate enemy is the software at the end of the day and not the people, and I just need to manage the people in the short term. But it is certainly true that, especially if your base bet goes up, and I have done some betting at higher bases, even yellow chip, your spread goes down. So there's some mathematical truth to it too, that their exposure goes down in some sense. And your ability to spread is reduced. But of course, you can take on a smaller edge at a higher bet, as long as your bankroll is big enough, and still make pretty good hourly. So I've seen that too, Richard. Generally my average game is a base of between 300 and 400 and spreading to 2x 6x, so 12-1 max is usually what I play. That gets me up into the 3-4K max bet. I'd be very uncomfortable betting too much more than that with a spread, because I think it just draws a lot of extra attention. But when you get in the right situation and you bet those yellows, I think it does. They do cool down a little bit. At least that's been my subjective assessment.
Yeah, no, I and several other players that I've talked to, we all kind of had that feeling that actually betting higher gets you more time, buys you more. Now you've mentioned a couple of times trading cover for longevity. So what kind of cover are we talking about?
Trading EV for longevity, yes, or for cover. So a number of things. One, there will be times when I'll play out a shoe, even though I know I'll even if the count's gone down, if the session has worked out a certain way, or I will not make the correct play in some cases. I don't follow a lot of the index plays. I think create too much exposure relative to their to the edge they
like
give
splitting
you.
Splitting tens.
Yeah, I never split tens. Basically, I do a lot of things out of band. But what I really try to do is find the plays that give me the best cover for the buck, if you will. And I also will just, I don't mind playing a break even game if that's what I need to do for a while, to generate history or to give an image for a session that makes it look less suspicious. So I've been willing to do that. And the hardest part is calculating what my EV is as a result of all those arbitrary kind of runtime decisions. So we've looked at that a lot. A couple of friends and I have done some analysis and tried to figure out. But one of the problems with all the tools is they don't make it very easy to model some of these play variations where you decide, okay, 16s, I'm going to just stand on all 16s, or this is going to be my surrender strategy, but it's going to be kind of on the fly. And I adjust what I do a lot of times, especially if I get another player at the table, which I actually like. I like one other player. It does happen in high limit. But, depending on what that other player's doing, I'll change how I play. Now, the computer could care less what antics, I'm putting on in the room. But I do think that there's a lot of value in kind of helping the humans see the story you want them to see and that they would prefer to see, rather than rousing suspicion and triggering a bunch of manual reviews and scrutiny from on high. So finding the right amount of cover is hard, but I estimate that I give up as much as 30-40% of my EV on average in my sessions. I'm happy with that.
So here's a situation that I always found difficult to deal with when I was counting. And that is you go in and you play the first two shoes and the count never goes anywhere. So you're basically making your minimum bet through two shoes.
Yep, I'm
and
out of there.
I always felt
at that point.
Like if I play a third shoe and the count goes through the roof, it's just going to be obvious that I'm a card counter.
Exactly. Yeah, when that happens to me, I mean, it's easy. I'm out of there. There's no question. It's not even I don't even have to struggle with that one.
So you just don't play the third shoe?
I don't play the third shoe, yeah. If the shoe's been flat and I can't put out any spread, unless there's a way I feel like I can make it convincing, like, somebody else comes in and all of a sudden the room goes crazy. For the most part, I can't. I don't think that looks like a typical better. At a high limit table, so why do I want to draw attention? So I'll just wait. There'll be another shoe another day, so I'll move on down the strip.
Now, did you play any other games other than blackjack, or employ any other methods other than counting cards?
Not really. I kind of wanted to. It'd be very interesting to find other edges, but I feel like hunting for those is something I'm not very good at. I have a short attention span, and I have a lot of blackjack opportunities, so I'm mostly stuck with that. I think if it was something I were going to do longer term, though, it would be prudent to spread out the effort and play some other games and spend some time looking at other opportunities. And it would be really fun to find some of those, but it wasn't something that I made an effort at. During last year, no.
At the end of your year, you still had $250,000 chips, or however many you had. Was getting rid of them any problem?
Yeah, I mean the problem with the chip banks at 15 casinos is your results in one casino vary enormously. So I could have a $20,000 bank at one casino that I just burn up you know, just giving them all my chips, getting beat over the head by the deck. And then the next casino, I win 50,000 and suddenly I have 80K in chips and I don't need anywhere near that many, right? So one of the things that's misleading about my number is I said I ended up at about 600 an hour for the time at the table, but I spent what I consider an inordinate amount of time just walking around, cashing out chips afterwards and rebalancing chips to get to where I had enough in my pocket that I could put big bets down in a really positive situation without, you know, without having to give up an ID or getting, you know, essentially told I can't play because I'm unwilling to give them my social security number. So, I probably spent another 150% as much time just dealing with the chips and the cash. And to be honest, it's kind of fun for a few trips to do all that. And then it gets really tedious. So if I were going to do it longer term, I think I would have, some people to help me and just, you know, dole out chips and get people to cash them out and move the money back and forth, which feels a little shady, but I mean, I didn't make those rules. That's just what it is. Once you hit 2000, you've got to start showing them what you're doing. So yeah, managing the chips and, burning them down and then cashing them out eventually when you're done, is a huge part of the game. But I like walking around. I enjoy seeing other people and just kind of moving between casinos anyway. So it's just good exercise. Probably log 15 miles a day walking on those Vegas trips.
Did your wife ever come in and cash out $1,500?
A few times I had her do it. I have a couple friends who live in Vegas, and they would come. I'd take them to a nice dinner, and in exchange, they would have to help me, move 10 or 20K of chips. But they enjoyed the sort of fun of being a little on the sly for some of those operations. But it was really helpful, actually, to have casinos that have a sister casino right next door and then have multiple cages. You can get 4 or 5 cages times 2K times 3 people. You can move a decent amount in an hour if you want to.
Yeah, and chains will take, you know, other in their chain. You can do that
right.
As well.
Yeah.
Did you ever have the problem of the boss wanting to know how you have 20 or 30,000 of chips coming out of your pocket as you're playing? You know, we've certainly run into that.
I try to be very careful and about having to bring on a large number of chips. I was most worried about that scenario where you just have a sky high count, you're losing hand over fist, and you need to keep putting those bets out because the EV is just so high on those last few. One of the nice things is that if you know, it tends to happen at the end. That's when the biggest swings in the count come. And so, it's a tricky thing. I don't think I ever had a problem, but I definitely had cases where I would gradually bring chips out of my pocket. And so they knew I had, some in reserve. And in general, since I was playing on a card, they could see if I'd won the day before or whatever, presumably the year, you know, the whole year, I guess the computer would let them see that. I didn't have too much issue, but I was really worried about it.
Yeah,
and it might be one of the reasons why I haven't had any backoffs is that I've been fortunate that I haven't had too many of those worst case scenarios where you need max cash in a huge losing, but very high EV scenario.
Yeah, on the one hand, though, it does mean you're losing when it happens, which they like.
They do, yes.
But it does kind of freak them out because the one job they have is to keep track of all the chips, and when you suddenly pour 20 or 30,000 of purple into their racks, it gets them all upset. But it's much worse when you're doing it as a refusal.
Yeah, on the card, I mean, they definitely struggled, and I tended to play, you know, during busier times. So I would not usually be was not the only person at the table. Although it's certainly more efficient to play solo, if you ignore the externalities. But yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing. I think there's an element there to having a personal stopping point as well, where you say, I don't care how good the rest of this shoe is. I put too much out here. I need to walk away from this as well, even though this is a huge positive scenario.
That would be hard to walk away from.
It's very, very hard, but you always have to, I mean, I guess, so one of the luxuries I had is that I was okay if I got burned out and didn't play anymore. I wasn't planning to be a blackjack player for the rest of my life, you know, as my full-time career. If you are thinking about it that way, I think you have to be much more diligent about setting those stopping criteria and trading longevity for the short-term EV. That's a hard problem hard question to answer, but it's one that I think any pro should probably address before they get to the table.
Did you attempt to disguise the amount you won or lost by either rat-holing or un-rat-holing chips to make the manual record different than what was actually true?
Nope, didn't try to do that. For one, I think if they ever looked at me, and they probably do with the camera, that would be a huge, I mean, the damage that would do would just totally outweigh any advantage of having them a little confused on my win or loss. The other thing is that about half my sessions were solo the whole time. And so in theory, in these very quiet rooms, I mean, these guys are bored out of their mind. They have nothing else to do. They should have an exact count. And so no matter what I do on my side fumbling around, they should be able to figure it out. And if it doesn't match very closely, then they're going to go look and see, and that's going to arouse suspicion. So I was very intentional about not doing that.
All right. We've been talking to Blade about his – actually, one more question. In 5 years, when you sell another one of your startup companies for $50 million, do you plan to spend another year playing blackjack?
Yes, I do. I would like to do it every so often in those spurts, and then have a long period for them to try to forget me and then come back as another person. I won't be Blade next time. I'll have to be somebody else, though. Maybe Bob has a nice ring to it.
That has a nice ring to it. You can, but spell it backwards so you don't get confused with me. One of the Blade contacted us about being on the show. I had not heard of him before he emailed us. I don't think Richard had heard of him. But and we're actually glad he did. This was an interesting segment. And so if you have something unusual that you think would appeal to a number of our listeners, don't be shy about contacting us. We will ask you some questions, and we'll want to know basically what you're going to talk about to make sure that you are indeed somebody we want to talk to. But if you think you have a story and a technique that would be of interest to our listeners, don't be shy about sending us an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. I want to thank Blade for sending the email and spending this hour with us. I want to thank Richard, and go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.